Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Ezekiel chapter 16. It's a long chapter, so I will only cover the first 29 verses. I will call this chapter The Lord's Faithless Bride. That would be referring to Judah, of course. The time of this prophecy is the same as the last several chapters between Ezekiel 8 and Ezekiel 19. All of those prophecies were given somewhere in the time frame of 592 to 590 BC. My timeline from Precept Austin has it at 592, but I don't think it's quite that exact. The important thing to note is that these prophecies are given right before the Babylonians came in 588 and before they finished destroying Jerusalem in 586. So we begin now in Ezekiel 16. I'll read verses 1 through 5. The word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, confront Jerusalem with her detestable practices and say, This is what the sovereign Lord says to Jerusalem. Your ancestry and birth were in the land of the Canaanites. Your father was an Amorite and your mother a Hittite. On the day you were born, your cord was not cut, nor were you washed with water to make you clean, nor were you rubbed with salt or wrapped in cloths. No one looked on you with pity or had compassion enough to do any of these things for you. Rather, you were thrown out into the open field, for on the day you were born, you were despised. Now in verse 2, God calls Ezekiel Son of Man, and as I have said in almost every chapter up to now, this is the title that especially applies to Ezekiel. Two possible reasons. One is that God is trying to keep Ezekiel humble by saying, Ezekiel, you have the characteristics of a man because you are the son of a man. You are infallible. You put your pants on one leg at a time. So don't get proud because you're a great prophet. The other theory is that God is making a type out of Ezekiel because Ezekiel is preaching against the rebellious house of Israel and in fact is predicting Jerusalem's downfall, even as Jesus did the same thing. The burning of Jerusalem that Jesus was predicting was in 70 AD. The burning of Jerusalem that Ezekiel was predicting was in 586 BC, and so that makes Ezekiel a perfect type of Jesus because the Son of Man is the title that Jesus called himself by. Nobody else called him that except him, with one exception. In Acts 7, Stephen called him that. I like that second option better, because there are parallels between Ezekiel and Jesus. Son of man, confront Jerusalem with her detestable practices. Now that would include idolatry, not to mention bloodshed, not taking care of the poor, all that kind of thing. As Adam Clark says, surely the state of the Jews before the Babylonish captivity was the most profligate and corrupt of all the nations of the earth. We're going to see later on in our next audio that God says, Sodom and Gomorrah hasn't got anything on you, Jerusalem. You're worse than they are. And of course, Sodom and Gomorrah are bywords for evil, as in the United States of Sodom and Gomorrah. Even to this day, we talk about Sodom as being the archetype of evil, and God says, Judah, you're worse than Sodom. In verse 3, God tells Jerusalem, your ancestry was in the land of the Canaanites. Well, actually, Abraham, the father of the Jews, he came from Ur of the Chaldees, right down near the Persian Gulf. In the Mesopotamian Valley, he moved up to Haran in Syria, and then he came on over into the Promised Land. And so why is God saying that the ancestors of the Jews were the Canaanites, the people who lived in the land of Canaan, the Promised Land? Well, the answer to that is simple. As John Gill says, the Israelites were the successors of the Canaanites in their land, and so seemed to descend from them. Gill also says that the Israelites were like to the Canaanites in their manners, particularly in their idolatries. And so God says, the Canaanites are your ancestors, your sons of Canaanites. Your father was an Amorite and your mother a Hittite, and those were two of the most prominent tribes of the Canaanites, as we talked about when we were in Genesis. The Amorites at one time spread all over Mesopotamian Valley. They were interesting because they weren't Semitic looking. They had red hair, I remember that. Light skin and red hair. The Hittites were the remnants of that great ancient empire that was situated in present-day Turkey. I think it went down around 1200 BC when the Sea Peoples came, but they were remnants of the Hittites, and they were all through the Promised Land. And so Ezekiel mentions the two most prominent of the Canaanite tribes. So obviously, God is speaking metaphorically here. Actually, Abraham and Sarah's mother and father were Chaldeans, were Babylonians. But note that actually, very soon, the Israelites married into the Canaanites. Judah did. We read in Genesis 38, verses 1 through 2. At that time, Judah left his brothers and settled near an Adullamite named Hirah. There, Judah saw the daughter of a Canaanite named Shuah. He took her as a wife and slept with her. Ah, yes, the lure of pagan women. It's a problem that's with us still, as Christians feel like they need to marry non-Christians and violate the scripture. In verse 4, God continues with the metaphor. On the day you were born, your cord was not cut. Now, that's very dangerous to both mother and child. You need to cut the umbilical cord. This refers to the fact that Israel was in a very dangerous situation as they left Egypt, obviously. They were ex-slaves, no military experience, wandering through a desert with all the women and children. It's a miracle, and it was a miracle that they ever made it to the Promised Land. And when they got there, they had to fight the Canaanites who were there who didn't want them to come in. So the picture of Israel being born in the Promised Land is a picture of a miserable baby that nobody takes care of. The baby's not washed with water, as you typically do with a newborn baby, because he's got all that, what's it called, vernix, the cheesy-looking stuff and the blood all over him. I'm always amused about how people say, oh, how cute the baby is. I remember when my oldest daughter was born, and I looked and I said, oh, my gosh, there's blood everywhere, that cheesy stuff. Oh, my gosh. I was set up. Nobody warned me about how that baby was going to look. But at any rate, you have to wash the baby with water. And here is an interesting practice of what the ancients did with their babies. They rubbed them with salt. Now, let me read you from a website I found that talked about medical practices of the ancient peoples, hekint.org. Not familiar with this website, but this is an interesting quote. Along with the symbolic and life-giving nature of salt throughout history, salting has been a part of traditional practices for millennia. Homer said salt was a sacred substance, and Plato described it as a dear substance of the gods. Salt thrown into the water is thought to increase its sacred properties, and Dioscorides emphasized the cleansing properties of salt. Galen recommended the salting of newborns to ensure a hard skin and better hygiene. Serenus described newborns being swaddled after sprinkling them with water and salt. Salting is performed as part of rituals of redemption. In the Bible, scrubbing with salt was among the practices recorded immediately after the birth of a baby. This practice is maintained today among some Jewish communities, as well as in Syria, Palestine, Jordan, Qatar, North Arabia, Western Iran, and Turkey. It is spread to some parts of the Balkans and Greece through the influence of the Turks. So you see, salting babies is a common thing. Preserve them. Make them strong. God says, you didn't get rubbed with salt, Israel, nor did you get wrapped in clothes. That means swaddled. Many ancient people swaddled infants to support their limbs. It was felt their muscles were too undeveloped to hold the baby together. Now, I don't think that's true because none of my kids were swaddled. They all came out okay, although I understand swaddling has come back because my grandkids apparently got swaddled. In verse 5, God tells Israel that no one looked on you with pity to do any of these things. What things? Cut the cord, wash with water, rub with salt, swaddle. Instead of that, you were thrown out into an open field. All of this represents Israel in its pitiful and helpless condition in Egypt as the nation was trying to be born. I think that Ezekiel is trying to recall all of the gracious practices of Yahweh in establishing Israel as a nation in order to highlight the Israelites' terrible apostasy and unfaithfulness, which of course is the theme of this chapter. We go now to Ezekiel 16, verses 6 through 8. Yahweh continues with the baby metaphor. Then I passed by and saw you kicking about in your blood. And as you lay there in your blood, I said to you, live. I made you grow like a plant of the field. You grew up and developed and became the most beautiful of jewels. Your breasts were formed and your hair grew, you who were naked and bare. Later I passed by, and when I looked at you and saw that you were old enough for love, I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your nakedness. I gave you my solemn oath and entered into a covenant with you, declares the sovereign Lord, and you became mine. So God comes by, sees an infant lying in the field, unwashed, unsalted, unswaddled, with the umbilical cord not cut yet. You have to stretch that a little bit because the mother would have to be there too, but this is an analogy. Now, note how very little Israel had to do with her salvation. Israel was helpless, kicking about in her mother's blood, lying there in the blood. Note to Armenians, she was helpless. She could not be saved on her own. Somebody had to come down and do it for her, as in irresistible grace. I made you grow like the plant of the field. So now the little baby's going to start growing. As Gil says, Jacob went down to Egypt with 75 persons only, but when his posterity returned from thence, they were above 600,000 that were able to go forth to war. Israel, of course, grew greatly while they were in captivity in Egypt. So God makes Israel grow like a plant. She became the most beautiful of jewels. Her breasts were formed and her hair grew. So I guess she's now reached the teenager stage. Now, it's God says her hair grew. Well, that sounds to me like the hair on her head, but John Gill says it was her pubic hair. Oh my gosh. I don't think so. You who were naked and bare. In verse 8, God continues and says, well, now that you're old enough for love, because her breasts were formed, God spreads the corner of his garment over her and covered her nakedness. Now that is referring to, as Adam Clark says, one of the Jews' initiatory marriage ceremonies. Clark refers us to Ruth chapter 3, verse 9, which I will read. So he, that's Boaz, asked, who are you? I am Ruth, your slave, she replied. Spread your cloak over me, for you are a family redeemer. So spreading a cloak over a girl meant, I want to marry you. It's kind of like today, people always get down on their knees with a ring in their hand, go through this silly ceremony if you ask me, but the women seem to like it. They start gushing, oh, I love you, I love you, yes, I'll marry you. Well, this was the equivalent in the Jewish kingdom. Spread the corner of the man's garment over the woman and make her not be naked anymore. And I don't know if that means naked, purely naked, or whether just without a cloak. And so God says at the end of verse 8, I gave you my solemn oath and entered into a covenant with you. An oath means covenant. It's synonymous. So the covenant at Sinai was like a marriage covenant between God and Israel. And in fact, Jeremiah 31 explicitly says that. I'll read that now. This one will not be like the covenant I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, a covenant they broke even though I had married them. Jeremiah 31:32, of course, is the famous prophecy of the new covenant. So the new covenant is not going to be like the old covenant, but the old covenant was a covenant they broke even though God had married them. So the covenant is compared to a marriage ceremony. Israel is the bride of Yahweh, and we're going to see that this bride is going to be very, very unfaithful. Continuing with the metaphor in verses 9 and 10 of Ezekiel 16, we read this. I bathed you with water and washed the blood from you and put ointments on you. I clothed you with an embroidered dress and put leather sandals on you. I dressed you in fine linen and covered you with costly garments. So God is getting Israel ready for the marriage ceremony, and he does a little recap here, goes back in time to when Israel was an infant kicking around in its blood. God says, I bathed you with water and washed the blood from you. And then we come up to the present where the nubile bride is ready for marriage. God put ointments on you. Now, washing with water was the standard Jewish ritual for cleansing. So whenever you see somebody being washed with water, that means they're ritually clean. I bathed you with water and put ointments on you. The King James has, I anointed you with oil. The NIV has, I put ointments on you. What does it mean that God anointed Israel with oil? God could be referring to the holy anointing oil with which the priest, the tabernacle, and the vessels were anointed to hold back in the Torah. He could be referring to the land of Canaan, which was a land of olive oil. In other words, I put oil on you because you were in Canaan now, in possession of Canaan, and I got some olive oil from all the olive trees that were there and put that olive oil on you. So that would be a natural reference, not a holy anointing oil, but just olive oil in general. Or option number three, God could be referring here to the custom of washing and anointing women before marriage. Let's read some scriptures that show that. Ruth 3, verse 3. Wash, put on perfumed oil, and wear your best clothes. This is Naomi talking to Ruth so that Ruth could get her man. Go down to the threshing floor, but don't let the man know you are there until he has finished eating and drinking. But you go down there with your oil on. Esther 2:12, during the year before each young woman's turn to go to King Ahasuerus, the harem regulation required her to receive beauty treatments with oil of myrrh for 6 months. So, women will rub down with that oil to make them pretty. So it's either holy oil, just olive oil as a symbol of prosperity, natural olive oil, or olive oil used particularly, or olive oil used especially to rub women down and make them pretty for marriage. And I think the latter is the best way to take that. And so God clothes the bride with dress, put sandals on her feet, fine linen. Of course, linen is always a symbol of purity. It was used by the priests, fine white linen. The saints in Revelation were clothed in fine white linen as a symbol of purity. So here's Israel, a beautiful new bride, pure, ready to be married to Yahweh. We go now to Ezekiel 16, verses 11 through 14. I adorned you with jewelry. I put bracelets on your arms and a necklace around your neck. And I put a ring on your nose, earrings on your ears, and a beautiful crown on your head. So you were adorned with gold and silver. Your clothes were of fine linen and costly fabric and embroidered cloth. Your food was fine flour, honey, and olive oil. You became very beautiful and rose to be a queen. And your fame spread among the nations on account of your beauty, because the splendor I had given you made your beauty perfect, declares the Sovereign Lord. So now we really see an image of a beautiful bride. And by the way, this verse was used by Douglas Wilson to show that it is no crime for Christian women to make themselves look nice for their husbands. Dress up, wear makeup, jewelry, anoint yourself with perfumes and oil. That's perfectly okay. If the barn needs painting, paint it. Now, one of these pieces of jewelry that's mentioned here is kind of problematic for a Westerner. I put a ring on your nose. Here's what John Gill says of that. Nose jewel, which was hung upon the forehead and reached down to the nose and mouth, and however disagreeable it may seem to us, was reckoned very ornamental in the Eastern countries. Well, that would be a chain wrapped around the forehead, and in the middle of the chain would be another chain, a pendant, if you will, hanging down with the ring sitting right on top of the nose. And yes, that does seem very ugly to me, but that's just a cultural thing. Different strokes for different folks. Now, this nose ring might not just be a ring hanging down on the nose. The ring might actually be piercing the nose through the septum, through that piece of skin that divides the two nostrils. Gill says that Eastern women like to do that, to pierce their noses so they could put jewels in their noses, sort of like modern day women, young women do today. I think it's perfectly ugly, but hey, to each his own. In verse 14, God says that the fame of this bride spread among the nations on account of her beauty. Now, of course, metaphorically, the beauty of Israel was its law, its revelation from God, the fact that they held Yahweh as being their God instead of these pathetic local deities that the nations of the ancient Near East worshipped. So she was beautiful, and her fame spread. I mean, after all, she came out of Egypt. Egypt? How in the world did this nation get out of Egypt? She whacked all the Canaanite nations. Well, what is Yahweh referring to here about the bride's fame spreading? I think, according to Jameson, Foster, and Brown, that this is referring to Israel under David and Solomon, especially Solomon, because when Solomon was king, Israel was the top dog in the ancient Near East. Assyria was weak, Egypt was weak, Babylon hadn't come into existence yet, and the Philistines were conquered, the Phoenicians were on good terms with the Israelites, Solomon had trade all over the world, he had a port down at Eilat on the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba. He was wealthy. People came from all over the world to talk to him about his wisdom. Yes, Israel was very, very famous right around 1000 B.C. Solomon ruled between 970 and 930 B.C. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say this: the theocracy reached its highest point under Solomon when distant potentates heard of his fame. For example, the Queen of Sheba. Sheba's down there probably near Yemen somewhere down in the Arabian Peninsula. Hiram, he was from present-day Lebanon, Phoenicia, Tyre, on the Mediterranean coast. Everybody knew about Solomon. We go down to Ezekiel 16, verses 15 through 19. God is now going to give us the bad news about his new bride. But you trusted in your beauty and used your fame to become a prostitute. You lavished your favors on anyone who passed by, and your beauty became his. You took some of your garments to make gaudy high places where you carried on your prostitution. Such things should not happen, nor should they ever occur. You also took the fine jewelry I gave you, the jewelry made of my gold and silver, and you made for yourself male idols and engaged in prostitution with them. And you took your embroidered clothes to put on them, and you offered my oil and incense before them. Also the food I provided for you, the fine flour, olive oil, and honey I gave you to eat, you offered as fragrant incense before them. That is what happened, declares the Sovereign Lord. Now these verses present a great metaphor. Israel is actually prostituting herself with a male idol. Now one thing about Ezekiel, he's not prudish. He says things that really ought not to be said in church. He gets to the point where this prostitution is almost not metaphorical but actual. Ezekiel is so graphic in his description. Israel is said to be beautiful in verse 15 by Yahweh. But as John Gill says, this beauty was a snare to the Israelites, as a woman's beauty is to her. And they were admired and courted and complimented by their neighbors, and so drawn into idolatrous practices, as women into fornication and adultery by the admirers of them. Now I will say, I have long noticed this, that people think that pretty girls, when they're young, they've got it made. Oh no, they don't. I was blessed and privileged to be in a homeroom in my high school that was full of the most lovely high school girls you have ever seen. And of course, I never talked to them because I was ugly, with acne, skinny, and with a buzzed-up haircut. So I had to admire from afar. But as time goes on and I kept going to the high school reunions, oh my gosh, the trials and tribulations of these beautiful women. For one thing, they weren't beautiful anymore by the time you get to the 30th reunion, divorced, beaten. Men treat them terribly. I remember one young lady she was a Janice Ian. She was not popular at all. She showed up at one of these reunions. She was so beautiful, and she was so successful in business. And my friend and I looked at each other in absolute amazement and said, can you believe this girl? She was blessed because she was not beautiful when she was young. So, little rabbit trail here. Don't trust in your beauty, girls. Don't do it, because people will abuse you because of it. They will be attracted to you for your beauty and not because of who you are. Here, Israel was using her beauty aggressively, going out and seeking lovers to make money so she could be a prostitute. She lavished her favors on anyone. Doesn't matter who they were. Any old idolater will do. She took some of her garment. In verse 16, she took some of her garments to make gaudy high places. I think what that means is the high places where idols were, and she took her garments up there on the high place and laid them out on the ground so they could get it on, so she could carry out her prostitution there. Gaudy high places. She took her jewelry, made idols out of the jewelry that God gave her. She made idols, in fact, with the gold and silver that God had given her, and then she engaged in prostitution with the idols. Of course, that's spiritual adultery. Israel even put her beautiful clothes on the idols, dressed them up, gave the idols oil and incense, and the food, flour, olive oil, and honey that God had given the Israelites. Israel had turned them over as offerings to the idols, turned the flour, olive oil, and honey into fragrant incense, and gave it to the idols and burned it before the idols. We go now to Ezekiel 16, verses 20 through 22. Yahweh continues, and you took your sons and daughters whom you bore to me and sacrificed them as food to the idols. Was your prostitution not enough? You slaughtered my children and sacrificed them to the idols. In all your detestable practices and your prostitution, you did not remember the days of your youth, when you were naked and bare, kicking about in your blood. Now this is referring to child sacrifice. Verse 20, you took your sons, your daughters, you sacrificed them as food to the idols. That's child sacrifice. That was prohibited in the law. Leviticus 18:21 says this, you are not to make any of your children pass through the fire to Molech. Do not profane the name of your God. I am Yahweh. Passing through the fire means probably to burn them up to the god Molech. Molech is the god that's most noted for requiring children to be sacrificed to him. That god was found in Ammon and Moab, also in Israel. I'll read you some verses in just a minute. Now, this phrase in verse 20, you sacrifice the children as food to the idols, the KJV translates as you passed through the fire, you passed the children through the fire. Now, there are a couple of ways to read that, three ways. Option number one, the Israelites first caused the babies to pass through two fires and then dedicated them to the idol. So they would lay out fires on the ground, pass the babies through the fire, then dedicate the baby to the idol, and then kill the baby afterwards. Option number two, the Israelites would cause the babies to pass between two fires. After they did that, they would dedicate the baby to the idol, and then they did not slay the child afterwards. As the Cambridge commentator, as cited by Wikipedia, says this, the words may refer to a ceremony of purification or a sacrificial offering. In other words, it could just be a ceremony of purification, not a sacrificial offering. I don't believe that, and I've got a great quote here from a gentleman named Christopher B. Hayes, who wrote a book called Death in the Iron Age 2 and in 1st Isaiah. We'll forgive him for calling Isaiah 1st Isaiah. On page 181, this is cited in Wikipedia under child sacrifice, quote, efforts to show that the Bible does not portray actual child sacrifice in the Molech cult, but rather dedication to the god by fire, have been convincingly disproved. Child sacrifice is well attested in the ancient world, especially in times of crisis. And I believe that's what God is talking about here. Israel, you sacrificed your children. You didn't just pass them through the fire and then dedicate them to an idol. You killed them. And of course, that's option number three. The Israelites slew the children by burning them in the fire, or maybe by putting them into the arms of the idol, which was made burning hot by a fire in the belly or the breast of the idol. Either way, the child is burnt up and killed. So I'm going to assume that. Now, we read two kings of southern Judah who actually did this. Let's start with Ahaz. Ahaz ruled between 732 and 716, 2 Kings 16:3. Ahaz walked in the way of the kings of Israel. He even made his son pass through the fire. Imitating the detestable practices of the nations the Lord had dispossessed before the Israelites, he made his own son pass through the fire. In other words, he murdered his own son, a king of Judah. 2 Chronicles has Ahaz sacrificing more than one child. 2 Chronicles 28:3. Ahaz burned incense in the valley of Hinnom. Hinnom, of course, was the valley south of Jerusalem. It was a trash dump, and they would always burn corpses there and trash there. And they also carried out child sacrifice there. Ahaz burned incense in the valley of Hinnom and burned his children in the fire. Notice the plural, burned his children. So that was Ahaz. And now Manasseh, who ruled later than Ahaz. Ahaz was 732 to 716. Manasseh is 687 to 642. Manasseh made his son pass through the fire. This is 2 Kings 21:6. Manasseh practiced witchcraft and divination and consulted mediums and spiritists. He did a great amount of evil in the Lord's sight, provoking him. Later on in Ezekiel, when we get there, Ezekiel 20 verse 26, we will see that Ezekiel is going to mention the Israelites' evil child sacrifice. Ezekiel 20, verse 26, and I pronounced them unclean because of their gifts, in that they caused all their firstborn to pass through the fire. Now, verse 20 says, these children were sacrificed as food to the idols. Molech is not mentioned there, but he was famous for child sacrifice. Leviticus 18:21 does mention Molech, so he's the famous child-consuming god. We go now to Ezekiel 16, verses 23 through 27. Yahweh continues, woe, woe to you, declares the sovereign Lord. In addition to all your other wickedness, You built a mound for yourself and made a lofty shrine in every public square. At the head of every street you built your lofty shrines and degraded your beauty, offering your body with increasing promiscuity to anyone who passed by. You engaged in prostitution with the Egyptians, your lustful neighbors, and provoked me to anger with your increasing promiscuity. So I stretched out my hand against you and reduced your territory. I gave you over to the greed of your enemies, the daughters of the Philistines, who were shocked by your lewd conduct. So now God is pronouncing woe on the Israelites. Verse 24, he says, you built a mound for yourself. As John Gill says, it was usual to erect high places in streets where altars were built and idols set up to be worshipped. It denotes the public manner in which they committed idolatry. A lofty shrine in every public square. So these were public idols at the head of every street. Israel degraded her beauty like a worn-out prostitute. She offered her body with increasing promiscuity. And by the way, prostitutes, as they get older, oh my gosh, do they get ugly. Because they're doing something that God didn't mean for them to do, and they turn ugly. Reminds me of a time when I was in China, in the city of Wenzhou, actually a suburb named Chashan, teaching at a university, and one of my colleagues there told me about a great massage place. I asked, is it Jin Gui? That means precious and honorable. In other words, it's not a house of prostitution. He said, oh no, it's fine. And he told me where it was. I'm new to the area, so I go down, and unfortunately, right near this Jin Gui massage parlor was a massage place that was a house of ill repute. I didn't know that. I go in the door, and this fat Chinese woman comes out just looking uglier than a horse. No, horses are beautiful. There's nothing really to compare her ugliness to that's in the natural world. And I remember thinking, this is strange, because usually, you know, the people who take your money and assign you a room and so forth in a Chinese massage house, they don't look like this. Found out later, unfortunately, to my chagrin, she was a prostitute. And so Israel is like that. The beauty that God has just described has become degraded, as he says in verse 25. Degraded. She's getting uglier and uglier the more prostitution she engages in. Now in verse 26, Israel engaged in prostitution with the Egyptians. Now we're going to spend some time talking about how Israel prostituted herself with Egypt, because usually we think of Egypt as being an enemy of Israel, and she was oftentimes. But many times, Israel sought alliances with idolatrous Egypt, mainly to protect themselves against the Assyrians, because Israel was sandwiched between the two countries. Well, let's look at that. How did Israel enter into prostitution with the Egyptians? As John Gill says, by entering into leagues and alliances with them and seeking to them for help and assistance against their enemies, from whose bondage they had formerly been delivered. Now, I am going to give you three examples of such Egyptian alliances. I think this is exhaustive. The first was by the northern king Hoshea, who ruled in the north between 732 and 722. In fact, he was the last king of the northern kingdom, capital at Samaria, the city in Ephraim. Hoshea thought he would deny Assyria tribute money. He's paying Assyria tribute to keep Assyria from coming down and stomping him. We read in 2 Kings 17:1 through 4, in the 12th year of Judah's king Ahaz. Ahaz ruled from 732 to 716. That's Judah's king. Hoshea's in the north. Hoshea, son of Elah, became king over Israel in Samaria and reigned 9 years. A little note on the 12th year of Ahaz. Ahaz started ruling in 732, but he also had a co-regency with his father from 735. So 735 minus 12 is around 733, 732, close enough. Hoshea became king over Israel and Samaria and reigned 9 years. He did what was evil in the Lord's sight, but not like the kings of Israel who preceded him. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, attacked Hoshea, and Hoshea became his vassal and paid him tribute money. But the king of Assyria discovered Hoshea's conspiracy. He sent envoys to So, king of Egypt, and had not paid tribute money to the king of Assyria as in previous years. Therefore, the king of Assyria arrested him and put him in prison. And if we keep reading on in the chapter, 2 Kings 17, we will see that Assyria then conquered Samaria and took the northern Israelites into exile in 722. So right before that exile, the northern kingdom of Israel was reaching out to commit prostitution with Egypt. Second case of prostitution with Egypt is when Judah under Hezekiah stopped paying tribute money to Assyria. This is about 701 BC. Hezekiah is king of Judah. He appeals to Egypt for help. We'll read that in 2 Kings 18, 19 through 21. Then the Rabshakeh, that's an Assyrian official outside the walls of Jerusalem, said to Hezekiah's representatives, "Tell Hezekiah this is what the great king, the king of Assyria, says. What are you relying on? You think mere words are strategy and strength for war? What are you now relying on so that you have rebelled against me? Look, you are now trusting in Egypt, that splintered reed of a staff that will enter and pierce the hand of anyone who leans on it. This is how Pharaoh, king of Egypt, is to all who trust in him." So apparently Israel had tried to get an alliance with Egypt, and as God said, that's prostituting herself before Egypt. Hezekiah was warned by Isaiah not to go to Egypt. We read in Isaiah 30, verses 1 through 7, "Woe to the rebellious children! This is the Lord's declaration. They carry out a plan, but not mine. They make an alliance, but against my will, piling sin on top of sin. They set out to go down to Egypt without asking my advice, in order to seek shelter under Pharaoh's protection and take refuge in Egypt's shadow. But Pharaoh's protection will become your shame, and refuge in Egypt's shadow your disgrace. For though his princes are at Zoan and his messengers reach as far as Hanes," those two Egyptian towns, "everyone will be ashamed because of a people who cannot help. They are of no benefit. They are no help. They are good for nothing but shame and reproach. An oracle about the animals of the Negev, through a land of trouble and distress, of lioness and lion, of viper and flying serpent. They carry their wealth on the backs of donkeys and their treasures on the humps of camels to a people who will not help them." That's Egypt. "Egypt's help is completely worthless. Therefore, I call her Rahab, who just sits." Rahab was another name for Egypt. "Rahab, who just sits." So that was the second time that Israel fornicated with Egypt. Now, to be fair to Hezekiah, some people say that Hezekiah probably didn't initiate contact with Egypt. He was forced into the alliance by his advisors. This is what Ligonier, R.C. Sproul's outfit, claims in an article. I don't know about that. It seems to me the king's responsible for what his advisors advise. I mean, after all, he is the king. Last example of how Israel committed fornication with Egypt. The last king of Judah, Zedekiah, who ruled from 597 to 586, he made an alliance with Hophra of Egypt to try to stop the Babylonians from wiping him out. Hophra, in fact, came to Judah after the Babylonian siege began in 588, and Nebuchadnezzar had to temporarily lift the siege of Jerusalem to go take care of Hophra, which he did, and then he came back and burnt the city of Jerusalem down in 586. Now, Jeremiah had warned against this alliance with Egypt. Jeremiah says in Jeremiah 46, verses 19 through 26, "Get your bags ready for exile, inhabitant of daughter of Egypt, for Memphis will become a desolation, uninhabited ruins. Egypt is a beautiful young cow, but a horsefly from the north is coming against her." That would be the Babylonians. "Even her mercenaries among her are like stall-fed calves. They too will turn back. Together they will flee. They will not take their stand, for the day of their calamity is coming on them, the time of their punishment." Talking about Egypt. Verse 22, Jeremiah 46, "Egypt will hiss like a slithering snake. For the enemy will come with an army. With axes they will come against her like those who cut trees. They will cut down her forest. This is the Lord's declaration, though it is dense, for they are more numerous than locusts. They cannot be counted." It's talking about the Babylonians. "Daughter Egypt will be put to shame, handed over to a northern people, the Babylonians. The Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, says, I am about to punish Ammon, god of Thebes." Thebes, of course, is the famous city in Egypt. "Along with Pharaoh, Egypt, her gods and her kings, Pharaoh and those trusting in him. I will hand them over to those who want to take their lives, to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and his officers." So Jeremiah told them, don't you ally yourself with Egypt, but they tried it again. So there's your example of how in Ezekiel 16, verse 26, God tells the Israelites that they have engaged in prostitution with the Egyptians. your lustful neighbors. Of course, the Egyptians are the neighbors of Israel, right there at the southwestern corner of Israel and the northeastern corner of Egypt. They touched right down there, the Wadi El Arish. So they were neighbors, and they're said to be lustful neighbors. Now, the King James has the translation of lustful as great of flesh. So the Egyptian neighbors of Israel were great of flesh. And John Gill says that that refers to the Egyptians' large private parts. The Holman Christian Standard Bible translates it this way, your well-endowed neighbors. In other words, to put it in the vernacular, God is telling the Israelites that their neighbors, the Egyptians, are well hung. And that's what you're interested in. That's how degraded you have become. And so God said he's provoked to anger by that, by their increasing promiscuity. It's just getting worse and worse. Now, this rather explicit language is commented on by Gill as he comments on Ezekiel 23:20, which I'll read now in advance before we get to that chapter, actually starting in verses 19, Ezekiel 23. Yet she multiplied her harlotries, remembering the days of her youth, when she played the harlot in the land of Egypt, talking about Israel, and she lusted after their paramours, whose flesh is like the flesh of donkeys. In other words, whose private parts are like the private parts of donkeys, and whose issue is like the issue of horses. Issue is semen. Now that is gross. But what a description of Israel's idolatry. I mean, Ezekiel takes the cake for literary ability. Now, I don't know Hebrew well enough to know whether the flesh is really like the body parts. I'd have to do some more research on that, whether the flesh is like the male private part. But issue like the issue of horses, I think that has to be semen. So I wouldn't be surprised. Now in verse 27, God says, because of Israel's promiscuity, I stretched out my hand against you and reduced your territory. That's the NIV translation. The King James says food. Many of the other translations say things like food, for example, rations and so forth, agreeing with the King James. For example, the Holman Christian Study Bible says, therefore, I stretched out my hand against you and reduced your provisions. So God is dealing with his wife Israel just like a husband whose wife was a whore would deal with his wife. He cut down on her expense account. I mean, I'd actually do worse than that. But so God didn't bless Israel anymore when she committed so much sexual immorality, idolatry. Now, of course, you could say that if we translate this as territory, as the NIV does, God reduced the territory of the Israelites. That happened in 722 B.C. They lost 10 tribes when the Assyrians took them away. However, at the end of verse 27, the reference is not to the Assyrians, but to the Philistines who reduced their territory or their provisions. I gave you over to the greed of your enemies, the daughters of the Philistines. Daughters means the people of, the population of, the Philistines, who were shocked by your lewd conduct. Now, John Gill says that this reference to the Philistines may refer to the times of Ahaz, who ruled from 732 to 716, when the Philistines invaded the cities of the Low Country in the south of Judah. That's the southwestern portion of Canaan, when the Philistines invaded those cities of the south of Judah and took many of their cities and brought Judah low. Gill cites 2 Chronicles 28:18-19, and so do the commentators Benson, Ellicott, and Pulpit. So I think we're all on the same page here. This reference to the Philistines is talking about how the Philistines reduced the provisions or the territory of the Jews. 2 Chronicles 28:18-19, the Philistines also raided the cities of the Judean foothills and the Negev of Judah and captured Beth Shemeth, Ajalon, Gederoth, Soko and its villages, Timnah and its villages, Gimzo and its villages, and they lived there. In other words, they reduced the territory of the Jews. For the Lord humbled Judah because of King Ahaz of Judah, who threw off restraint in Judah and was unfaithful to the Lord. So I think that's probably what Ezekiel is referring to here, or Yahweh is referring to here. The Philistines reduced the provisions or the territory, depending on how you translate that. The Philistines reduced the Israelites. And it says, the Philistines, these pagans, even they were shocked by your lewd conduct. Now, it takes a lot to shock a pagan idolater. All of the pagans, not just the Philistines, felt shocked and felt that, quote from John Gill, the Jews became mean and despicable when they fell into idolatry and under the displeasure of God whom they forsook as a common strumpet becomes, in process of time, loathsome to her quondam lovers. A strumpet is a whore, and quondam means former. I love that word, quondam. In other words, Israel was so idolatrous that even the idolaters were shocked by it. Talk about dragging Yahweh's name through the mud. Happens a lot today, but boy, I tell you, the Israelites were world class when it came to disgracing the name of their God. We go now to Ezekiel 16, verses 28 through 29, and we will be finished with the first half of this chapter 16, and we will be finished with this audio. Ezekiel 16, starting at verse 28, "You engaged in prostitution with the Assyrians too, because you were insatiable, and even after that, you still were not satisfied. Then you increased your promiscuity to include Babylonia, a land of merchants, but even with this, you were not satisfied." All right, so when did the Israelites engage in prostitution with the Assyrians? As John Gill says, this was done in the times of Ahaz. He ruled from 732 to 716, who sent to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, for help. That's Tiglath-Pileser III. And by the way, even though Ahaz started ruling in 732 on his own, he was co-regent with his father Jotham. And so about 735 is when Ahaz went to Assyria for help. We read about this in 2 Kings chapter 16, verses 7 through 9. "So Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, 'I am your servant and your son. March up and save me from the power of the king of Aram,'" that's Syria, "and of the king of Israel." There was a Syrian northern kingdom of Israel alliance against Ahaz. And so Ahaz goes to Assyria for help. So Syria and Israel, northern Israel, are rising up against me. Ahaz also took the silver and gold found in the Lord's temple and in the treasuries of the king's palace and sent them to the king of Assyria as a gift. So the king of Assyria listened to him and marched up to Damascus and captured it." So we see Israel engaging in prostitution with Assyria. But Israel's lusts were not satisfied. She increased her promiscuity. She gave herself to the Babylonians. Babylonia is called a land of merchants. Now, there's a translation issue here. J.P. Green's literal translation translates it this way: "And you have multiplied your fornication in the land of Canaan to the Chaldean." So merchants is Canaan. And in fact, many other translations translate it that way. They have Canaan instead of merchants. So the Israelites would be said to be committing fornication in Canaan land with Babylonia. Now, that's kind of strange. Well, it's probably referring to trade with Babylonia, not specifically idol worship. So the promiscuity was in adopting idols resulting from that commerce. As Barnes puts it, "Trading and forming alliances with Chaldea, Babylonia, and in so doing were attracted by the idolatries of those with whom they carried on commerce." Here's what Ellicott says: "Israel, beginning its idolatries in the actual Canaan, had extended them along with her commercial intercourse on every side, until at last she had carried them even to Chaldea," that's Babylon, "the great commercial emporium of the time." Well, I think that's reasonable. And so, to summarize, Israel is engaged in prostitution with the Egyptians, the Assyrians, and the Babylonians. The Babylonians, of course, were the successor kingdom to the Assyrians in the Mesopotamian Valley. Israel was a whore. Let me finish up here by quoting Ezekiel 23, verses 14 through 16, which specifically refers to Israel's whoring after Babylon. "So she," that's Israel, "increased her harlotries, and she saw men portrayed on the wall, images of the Chaldeans portrayed with vermilion, girded with belts on their loins, with flowing turbans on their heads, all of them looking like officers, like the Babylonians in Chaldea, the land of their birth. And when she saw them, she lusted after them, and sent messengers to them in Chaldea." Well, we are finished describing the pathetic decline of the nation of Israel with some of the best purple prose you can imagine. Ezekiel would get an A in literature, in my humble opinion. We're now prepared to go to Ezekiel 16, verses 30 to the end of the chapter, and our next audio, verses 30 to 63. And we will call this chapter, "The Lord Forgives His Faithless Bride." So we will end up the chapter on a happier note. So I hope you stay tuned for that, and I hope you enjoyed the discussion of this chapter.